DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, deep and dirty in the worlds of science and technology, as ever. I'm Zulfi Karabani. So we've all downloaded Twitter's hashtag music app or not, but did you spot the paid-for tweets? It's a growing trend and we've got the lowdown.
We basically provide the possibility for influencers to make money by sending out a tweet for a specific company. And what we say is we let the influencer determine which kind of message they want to send. So it's basically up to them, in consideration with, of course, the briefing by the brand. So what we basically do is we add a short code. It's called hashtag AD, but in the future it might be hashtag ADV.
Also on the program, tips on how to cross the digital divide, and Google taps white space in South Africa to expand internet coverage. All that and more right here on Spectrum. But first, we all hope the new technologies will help doctors treat various illnesses, and that a lot faster than in the past. But cancer is still the leading cause of death worldwide. Most often, patients are diagnosed with cancer in the final stages, when it's too late to treat the disease. And that's usually the case with gastric cancer too. But that might soon change, as Latvian scientists have invented a new method for diagnosing gastric cancer in its initial stages. From Riga, Gennads Gelzitz reports.
The scientist switches on a shaker at a lab of Latvian Biomedical Research and Study Center in Riga. A team of seven researchers have spent the past 6 years studying gastric cancer, and they have just made an exciting discovery that could significantly improve the diagnosis of gastric cancer. The scientists have found what are known as the autoantibodies of cancer-associated antigens. Sounds complicated? Well, that's molecular biology for you. To put it simply, our immune system creates antibodies which fight viruses or bacteria, but our immune system can also produce autoantibodies. They see the body's own tissues as foreign and so try to neutralize them. The antibodies identify the foreign elements by way of antigens, substances that cause the immune system to react to unknown objects. And it's these antigens that are the basis of the study. Aili Linné is a chief scientist at the Biomedical Research Center.
In the first step, we try to identify so-called cancer immunome, which basically is a set of antigens that human immune system can recognize and produce antibodies against.
Linné and her team of researchers initially tried to discover all the antigens against various types of cancer, but it was their study of gastric cancer, published in the International Journal of Cancer in January, which made other scientists take note with surprise, says Linné. Basically, they have found the key making diagnosis easier.
We have identified a set of 45 antigens. If we detect autoantibodies against these 45 tumor antigens, we can detect the presence of cancer with approximately 60% sensitivity. In other words, this means that from 100 gastric cancer patients, we could correctly identify 60.
To do this, the scientists use various high-tech devices and elaborate calculations to find the autoantibodies against the cancer. Everything starts with a patient's tumor tissue taken by a doctor during surgery. The specimen is sent to a laboratory where scientists extract the genetic information from it. Linné shows me an image on the lab's computer showing the results of an analysis. There is a pattern of many green and red spots which reveal how the immune system has reacted to gastric cancer, explains Linné.
Each of these spots represent one single antigen. Those spots that react with patient zero, you can see these bright red spots. And this means that the serum sample has antibodies against tumor-associated antigen, while we never see reactivity against these antigens in healthy controls.
According to the World Health Organization, gastric cancer is the fourth most widespread form of cancer in the world. It's caused by the Helicobacter pylori, which form in the stomach. Marty Slayer, a gastroenterologist at Riga Eastern Clinical University Hospital, explains why the research is so important for Latvia.
Latvia has some of the highest rates of gastric cancer. If we look at it on the international level, we assess the rate of incidence among 100,000 people. And in these terms, we have quite a high level. Each year, around 600 people fall ill with this illness in Latvia.
Leah says that there's no way to treat the gastric cancer. Most often, the disease is detected in its advanced stages when it's already too late for treatment. Doctors often use endoscopy to detect the cancer, a complicated and expensive procedure whereby a thin tube with a tiny camera is inserted into a patient's body. There are other tests, such as the pepsinogen test, but they are not always effective. So this discovery by the Latvian scientists is very important, says Rolando Herrero. He's the head of the Prevention and Implementation Group at the International Agency for Research on Cancer.
The most important is to make sure that at the population scale, I mean, when this test is applied in large population, that it's able to detect the early cancers that are present in that population. So that requires a different study design that is relatively complex and sometimes very costly.
For now, Linnea and her team of scientists will continue their research. They hope to invent a simple blood test for gastric cancer. They say there is an urgent need for such a screening method in countries like Japan, Korea, and Latin America, and the Baltic states, where the disease is very common. But according to Herrero, as our populations continue to age, the cancer is here to stay. Jadars Geozis, DW, Riga.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Well, you may or may not have been able to escape all the brouhaha late last week over Twitter's hashtag music app. I use the term brouhaha specifically because it means I can quote Wikipedia's definition of the word, which reads as follows: a state of social agitation when a minor incident gets out of control. Make of that what you will. However, one of the most striking things that struck me about Twitter hashtag music was the string of tweets from American music artists on Twitter's official blog entry for the affair, all exclaiming instantaneously the app's virtues. The thought that some of these tweets may have been paid for tweets crossed my mind, and even away from Twitter's music app. So you too may have been wondering recently what, for instance, hashtag spon is all about. Well, in the Netherlands, Peter Teffer has been thinking about it too. In fact, he's been asked to do a few himself.
Hi, sir, madam. I was wondering whether you'd be interested in selling advertising space on peterteffer.com. The advertisement would be unobtrusive, and we can pay you an annual upfront payment for the advertising space.
The first time that I received an email from a Wendy Stevenson from Media Discovery, I discarded it because it resembled a spam message. But a week later, I received a second email from Wendy Stevenson, which suggested that an actual person was behind the messages. In her follow-up email, Ms. Stevenson emphasized her company offers a very attractive system of advertising. Although I felt there would be too many ethical problems with advertising on my journalistic website, Ms. Stevenson caught my curiosity. I found out that Media Discovery wanted me to write an article or blog post of about 300 words that was in some way relevant to their client, the advertiser. Ms. Stevenson sent me an example of how such an ad would look. It linked to a blog post on a website called My Car Reviews. The blog post had one link, but there was no indication that this was an advertisement. And in fact, Ms. Stevenson had said so in her email.
As you can see, it looks just like a regular article or blog post.
I replied to ask how many other bloggers have cooperated and whether they were allowed to tell their readers that a link was an advertisement.
Dear Peter, my apologies for taking a while to get back to you. Unfortunately, the campaign we initially had in mind for your site has already reached their target sooner than expected. Even though we are unable to pursue our original offer at the moment, I will come back as soon as a relevant campaign comes up, or if our client increased their target numbers. Yours, Wendy.
I must have been asking too many questions. The rejection came only 4 hours after Ms. Stevenson was still hoping for a new and exciting partnership. But now, suddenly Media Discovery was no longer able to pursue their original offer. But my story isn't that surprising, at least not for Matthijs Raumann, who works as a communication strategy director in Utrecht, the Netherlands. Even though I, like most internet users out there, didn't know of such advertising companies, Raumann has heard of them.
Consumers now have a voice because of social media. anyone can tweet or write or blog or Facebook about the things they see in their lives. And that's something that advertisers see as an opportunity to spread a message about their brand or about their products.
But it is not always clear whether a sponsored tweet is in fact paid for or not. If a consumer sees a message and only later finds out that it was an advertisement, this can severely damage the consumer's trust in the brand.
What we see in the field is that people eventually dislike the people that are spreading the message and the brand itself because they are unaware of the relationship between the advertiser and the one that's speaking about the product. When I know that you're writing in favor of a brand by being paid for it, it's a whole different kind of thing than when you're writing about it from an honest opinion.
That's why it's important that someone who gets paid to promote a product in a blog post or tweet should disclose that, says Raumann. He was involved in writing an ethical code for the Dutch Trade Organization for Direct Marketing and Sales Promotion. This social media marketing code applies to all 270 companies that are a member of the Dutch Dialogue Marketing Association. The code suggests that disclosure can be done by adding a hashtag and the letters SPON for sponsored or AD for advertisement. Dutch entrepreneur Dirk Zeilenberg recently found himself in a controversy when he argued adding a hashtag would not be necessary. He had asked Dutch celebrities to promote a Dutch film on Twitter, urging that they make the message sound as non-commercial as possible. But now Mr. Zeilenberg appears to have bettered himself. His company, Spread the Brand, will suggest to its users to use a hashtag like AD, says the company's co-founder, Ton van het Noordende.
We basically provide the possibility for influencers to make money by sending out a tweet for a specific company. And what we say is we let the influencer determine which kind of message they want to send. So it's basically up to them, in consideration with, of course, the briefing by the brand. So what we basically do is we add a short code. It's called hashtag AD, but in the future it might be hashtag ADV.
The big question, of course, is what happens when users of Spread the Brand, these so-called influentials, delete this hashtag? Who will then be responsible? The influentials, the advertiser, or Spread the Brand? This is uncharted territory. Since the Netherlands has one of the most active Twitter communities in Europe, it is one of the countries where these kinds of problems have come up first. In the UK, the Advertising Standards Agency Authority has told Nike to ban tweets by football player Wayne Rooney, in which it had not been clear that they were part of Nike's campaign. Most countries have self-regulatory bodies like the ASAA, but there is no pan-European code of ethics on this matter. In the Netherlands, the ethical code will probably be adopted later this year by the Dutch Advertising Code Authority, which has been responsible for self-regulation of the advertising business in the Netherlands since the 60s. That will give a lot more weight to the code, and will give power to potential consumers who feel misled. However, that probably won't help me find out more about this shady company, Media Discovery. Miss Stevenson never again replied to my emails. A request to the general email address that has been published on Media Discovery's website went unanswered, and so have several phone calls to the UK number advertised.
The person you're trying to reach is not available. Please leave a message after the beep.
Peter Zeffer, DW, from Utrecht and Amsterdam, the Netherlands.
Ever felt like you were on the wrong side of the divide? Well, the World Economic Forum's latest technology report suggests that most developing nations are still struggling to cross the digital divide, and it means they're unable to, or could mean that they're unable to take full advantage of our digital world, whether that's financially or in terms of education and skills and engineering and stuff like that. I spoke to the report author Thierry Geiger and asked him why.
Unsurprisingly, Sub-Saharan Africa continue to lag behind. But across the entire developing world, we see gaps and shortcomings and enormous room for improvement. And not only in technology penetration, so internet usage and broadband access, etc., but also in all the framework conditions. So things that have to do with skills, property rights, content, infrastructure, digital content, etc. So
just explain that just a bit in more depth when you talk about the skills and the digital content.
Yes. For example, the traditional definition of digital divide and the fact that it is traditionally been seen as a lack of access to technology, and people tend to believe that by improving, you know, a mobile telephony, for example, penetration is enough to bridge this gap. And yes, we've experienced and we've observed double-digit growth in terms of mobile telephony. But what we're seeing in our reports and our research is that this is not enough. You need to improve also on the framework conditions, because without the skills, without the literacy among the population, you cannot take full advantage of technology.
So when you talk about the skills, you're talking about not only the skills in knowing how to use the technology, but also how to develop the technology locally, right?
Yes, and exactly. It's the notion of innovation. So both from a user perspective, you know, how can you, if you cannot read or if you cannot use a computer, you cannot take full advantage. And you cannot also contribute to the content because skills contribute to innovation and contribute to creating a conducive environment for innovation, for technology, for entrepreneurship, etc.
Well, you mentioned access to mobile devices, and just the other week we spoke to the Indian communications minister, Kapil Sibal, who made that very point as well, that in India that was really a vital point. And I could pinpoint India for the moment. It is, if you look at some statistics, third in the world in terms of its internet users. It has about 150 million internet users. But at the same time, you place it at about 68. I think 68 it comes on your list of network readiness index. It's at place 68. How should we understand that? There's a lot of internet users. Yeah. It comes third in the world in terms of internet users, and yet on your list of networked readiness, it is very low.
Well, that's interesting indeed, because you mentioned 150 million internet users, but it's a little bit more than 10% of the population. So it's still far from universal usage and far from the rates you observe in even China, so where you have about 40% of the population accessing the internet on a regular basis. So 10% penetration for internet is quite low by international standard. An interesting case is mobile telephony in India. I mean, they are probably one of the countries where mobile telephony has grown the fastest. Indeed, we observe that India is the cheapest place on earth for technology usage, so for the cost of technologies. But for all the other technology, personal computers, broadband access to the internet, just for example, the broadband internet subscription, it's just one connection per 100 population.
In India?
One broadband access subscription per 100 population. It's really, really small. And this explains partly why India is ranked so low.
I wonder, because you mentioned sub-Saharan Africa, there are also some relatively good stories, positive stories in some African countries. What can you tell us about the African countries that are doing well?
Well, the countries that tend to do well in the region are smaller countries such as Mauritius. And, arguably it's easier to deploy technology and to embrace technology when you're a small country. I mean, the challenges are smaller than, for example, India or China when it comes to deploying technology among the population. So Mauritius is typically a country that tends to do relatively well. And South Africa also is unsurprisingly one of the best performing countries in Sub-Saharan Africa. But by and large, we see that Sub-Saharan Africa really lags behind in terms of penetration of technology, but also in all this aspect of quality aspect, that the environment is not very conducive, and therefore the impact in terms of access to services, creation of new business models, quality of the interaction with government is still very small.
So we've spoken about a little bit about Asia, a little bit Africa. Just let's focus on the top 10, just very briefly. The top 10 features seven European countries, so that paints a rather good picture of Europe. It also includes the United States, but there you've said that there are certain political and regulatory aspects that are actually limiting the benefits of technology in the United States. That's quite a remarkable statement.
In the US, there are some concerns about the quality of these framework conditions and the political deadlock in the US, which has consequences on the budget, on the capacity to invest. Infrastructure, even digital infrastructure, is affected, the capacity to deploy broadband across the country. And again, situations around the laws and property rights, all these things are not great in the US. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's still very good by international standards, but it's not as good as some of the best performers, such as the Nordics. Typically, the Nordics, led by Finland, but also the Asian Tigers, led by Singapore, tend to do very well across the board, whereas in the US, it's not necessarily the case.
Thierry Geiger, author of the World Economic Forum's latest technology report there. And you're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW Online. We're at dw.de/spectrum. And you can, of course, follow us at dw_SciTech. Well, the internet firm Google has started a new project in Cape Town, South Africa, as it plans to transmit broadband internet over TV frequencies, which are not being used by the TV networks. This could get internet access to people who live in areas where cable fails to reach. 10 local schools have been connected to the internet so far. Sean Sinico has this report by Andreas Herler.
The idea sounds quite simple. Google wants to take advantage of unused frequencies, technically the uninhabited space that sits between the frequencies of South Africa's various TV channels. These free frequencies are known as white space, and Google wants to use them to help people get connected to the internet, as Google South Africa's strategy manager Fortune Sibanda explains.
This new technology, what it simply does is it actually uses these spaces in between the television channels to deliver internet services. So the main thing really about this trial is that we want to see if we can deliver internet services using what we call these white spaces without actually causing interference to the primary users of that spectrum.
But it's not as simple as it sounds. That's because TV antennae cannot process internet signals. So Google's going to need some new technology.
So what we did here in South Africa, in the South African trial, is that you actually have to build the receivers specifically for that environment, because these receivers and transmitters have to work within certain limits, and those limits are what channels are available for use and what channels are occupied. So you have to custom build it for a specific area. So this is what we had to do. I think this is the majority of the work that we had to do actually for Cape Town.
Several local organizations are working with Google on the project. Among them are the South African Telecommunications Regulation Authorities and TANET, a network of higher education institutions. Already 10 schools are connected to the new internet technology. All the schools are equipped with special gear, which ensures that the internet transmissions do not interrupt TV reception. Fortuna Sibanda from Google hopes the process will be successful.
This is very important, especially for Africa, at least we feel it is, because the advantage of using television white spaces is that it has a far greater reach. The signal can travel up to 10 kilometers, which makes it very suitable for regions such as us in Africa, where we do not have great telecoms infrastructure. So that way you can deploy broadband internet services without really having to put a hotspot every other 100 meters as Wi-Fi is currently working.
Whether more parts of Africa are connected to the broadband internet in the same way remains open. It depends on how successful the test operation is. And we should know within about 6 months when the test ends.
Sean Sinico with that report there by Andreas Herler. Now, the sight of a shark tends to scare people. I bet it scares you too. But there are things that could mean that sharks are something to be admired. Something to be admired about the elegant yet vicious predators, that is. Engineers in Germany believe shark skin is a secret weapon that, if unlocked, could help shipmakers create faster and fuel-efficient vessels. DW reporter Mark von Lübke was in Hamburg to find out. Chiponda Cembalu has his report.
When sharks glide in water, they exude a powerful elegance. It can look as though they are hardly moving. That's because a shark's skin is such that it provides a lot less friction than, for instance, the hull of a ship. Christian Johansen works at the Hamburg Ship Model Basin. It's where ship design is tested. He says the special structure of the scales on a shark's skin significantly reduces friction.
The shark's resistance to the current is reduced through a groove structure on its skin. So sharks can swim faster with the same amount of energy. Or put another way, they can maintain the same speed for a longer time with the energy they have.
These characteristics have led shipbuilders and operators to want to imitate the sea predators. The idea is simple. Lower resistance means a ship needs less fuel and engine power. And that would lead to fewer emissions, meaning that both the shipping industry and the environment benefit. But wouldn't a shark's rough skin increase resistance? Christian Johansen.
It's a fallacy to think that a smooth surface has the lowest resistance.
A grooved structure is much better. Riblets, or movable scales that extend from a shark's head to its tail fin, reduce friction when they are parallel to the direction of movement. For ships, they prevent the formation of unwanted, energy-consuming cross-currents between the ship's hull and a layer of water where the current is undisturbed. But the fact that riblets make sharks high-speed hunters has been known for a long time. What is yet to be tested extensively is whether a similar structure could also work on large container ships. A project led by the Fraunhofer Institute for Manufacturing Technology and Applied Materials Research is testing the use of riblet coatings on large ships. The collaboration involves the Hamburg Ship Model Basin, or HSVA, and it goes by the German name of Hightech Projekt, a neat play on the German word for shark, high, so you get Hightech, or Shark Tech. The HSVA's facilities are being used to test whether the energy-saving riblet effect in sharks will work on large ships. The Hamburg-based test facilities offer the best test conditions. Since 1913, models have been tested and improved in large pools here, which include a large ice pool. In this case, the hydrodynamics and cavitation tunnel was used as a primary test site. Workers at the Fraunhofer Institute coated an 8-meter-long torpedo-shaped object with riblet film and placed it in water which was being pumped through a huge pipe about the size of a wind tunnel.
You need a large vessel and high speed.
Christian Johansen explains the requirements of the experimental setup. The water rushes past the torpedo-shaped object at 36 kilometers per hour, and the result is that the higher the speed, the more the riblets reduce resistance. So, ships could save fuel with riblet coatings by going faster too. That could save an average ship owner about $300,000 per year. However, since large container ships are at sea for many years, the special coating will have to survive rough ocean conditions over a long time. To find out about the wear and tear of this resistance-reducing riblet effect, the engineers passed sandpaper over the surface.
We found that as soon as the structure is worn down by about 50%, it's almost lost all its effectiveness.
The riblets, which start at a height of 25 micrometers, were gradually worn down until the engineers had reduced them to just 13 micrometers. And at that point, the special sharkskin coating stopped having any effect. But there was something else worrying the researchers too. The mussels and barnacles that grow on a ship hull. They tend to increase a ship's resistance to the current, slowing it down. So the next part of the experiments will be to discover how the engineers can protect their special shark tech skin against the pesky little shellfish hitching a ride.
Chibonda Chimbelu with that report there by Mark von Lübke. Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. And you can listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. I'm Zulfikar Ebani. Our studio tech was Gerd Gyorgy. Hope you can make it next time. Till then, thanks for listening and bye for now.